Hello and welcome to episode 2 of season 3 of A Positive Podcast. It's wonderful to be back. It's been a while and I'm glad to be able to share with you today a very interesting podcast. Today's podcast is sponsored and powered by OK Clarity. More about them later in the show. If you would like to sponsor an episode, please reach out through my website, apositivecoach.com, to sponsor another episode. If you are curious to hear more about positive coaching and to see if coaching is a fit for you, you can reach out and set up a free consult through my website, apositivecoach.com. So today's episode is an interesting episode, in my opinion. And we're talking about another podcast that you may have heard of, Barry Weiss on Honestly. She had an episode titled Why the Kids Are Not All Right. And if you haven't yet heard it, you might want to go take the time to listen to it. It's interesting, and it's going to give you a background to understand this episode that we're sharing with you today. After listening to that episode, I had friends and family members, coaching clients, other coaches reach out, or I reached out to discuss this episode, and it brought up a lot for all of us. And I realized that obviously this was an episode that really got us all thinking and kind of bringing us back to the drawing table to figure out where we wanted to go with all this information and what our thoughts were about it. So I reached out to two wonderful people to create today's episode. First off, I started up with a conversation with my sister-in-law, Dina Schusterman, who is a shlucha. She's a parent of 8 children. She's an educator, and she's someone who's also well-versed in conscious discipline. And in my opinion, she has a very good clarity and has an ability to be able to understand things in a very clear way. And we discussed what this episode brought up for many of us, why so many of us were struggling with it, what things we need to take from it, what things we don't necessarily agree with. And in the second part of this episode, I sit down with Dina Gorkin, a well-known educator. She's the founder and principal of Manos Chomish Academy High School. She has lectured extensively on topics of education and parenting, and she's someone who I really respect and someone who has a very good understanding of parenting styles that really work. So I think you're going to find today's episode thought-provoking, interesting, and it's going to leave you with some tools and ideas to help you find that balance that you need to parent your children in the way that works for you and your family, and help all of us bring this next generation and get them ready for Mashiach. So sit back, relax, and be ready to grow. The Positive Podcast is brought to you by OKClarity.com. OKClarity is the place for any Jew, no matter how religious you are, to find an excellent therapist, psychiatrist, coach, or nutritionist, and it's completely free for you to use. OKClarity.com's professionals are vetted, and they have extensive experience working with the Jewish community. Yes, you can even find me there, because I'm listed as a coach. If you're in the market for a therapist, a coach, a nutritionist, a psychiatrist, or the like, you want to check them out. If you don't find what you're looking for, they have a concierge service where you complete a short form and they will personally match you with someone. Just an important side note, if you are a wellness professional, I highly recommend joining their directory. Their team is amazing and I've received referrals from their platform. And OK Clarity has an amazing WhatsApp status with over 8,000 obsessed followers. And yes, I am one of them. Their WhatsApp is a free way to improve your mental health, and they post great humor, so you'll laugh too. If you have WhatsApp, shoot them a message at 917-426-1495. Again, that's 917-426-1495. We'll put the links to their website and their WhatsApp in the show notes, so you can find those links and go ahead, smash those links. You will not regret it. And now, back to our show. So welcome, Dina Schusterman, my sister-in-law. Such a pleasure to have you on finally on our podcast.
Exciting.
Very exciting.
I think people will finally get the difference, because how many times have people asked me if I have a podcast? So now that I'm here, people will know the difference.
Yeah, because we look alike, right? I get that too. But it's an honor to have you on. So the reason why I asked you to come on actually is because I really feel like you have a certain clarity around this. We've discussed this off of this podcast, obviously. And I felt like there was really some really good points that you brought up, and you had, some good questions and some good takeaways. And I wanted to share that because I feel like people can benefit a lot from this conversation. So I want to start off by asking you, obviously we're talking about this podcast by Barry Weiss, Are the Kids All Right? Why the Kids Aren't All Right.
And it's based on this book by Abigail Schreier, which I have to say, again, I did not read it. I have it on my counter. It's here. I'm actually going to read it at the Shabbos, hopefully. So I may have some more things to share afterwards. But I want to discuss this with you and kind of like parse apart the what's coming up here. So my first question is what is coming up for all of us that we're so, I don't want to say triggered because I don't like that word, but why is it causing such a firestorm? Why is this podcast getting us so uncomfortable? What are your thoughts on that?
Okay, so first of all, I also only listened to the podcast. I didn't read the book. I think that it created a lot of excitement or anxiety or nerves or anger or resentment, whatever it created, is because on one hand, it was meant to do that, right? Like the title is very provoking, and it's counterculture right now. So all of that is on purpose. So we all just fell into that trap of like, and then it's one of those type of, just from the podcast, it felt like it was one of those things that just puts people back into their specific corners. Like all the confirmation bias is there. All the people who are against therapy are going to say, "See, I told you so. It's terrible. We've just ruined another generation." And all the people who are like scratching their head are like, okay, another one of these, whatever name you want to give it, wackos are coming to ruin all the progress we've made. So I think that is very intentional, and that's why we are stirred up about it. Personally, I think that it brought up a lot for me because I go into this space of fear, like, oh no, what if I've moved into this next century? And what if I was supposed to stay in the last century? What if I have learned new things and learned new tools and I wasn't supposed to, because in some imaginary world, I'm still supposed to be living in the shtetl? I don't know why Hashem doesn't have me in the shtetl, but for whatever reason, I'm supposed to still be there. Like there's a whole narrative around non-progress.
And why do you think there's such a big swath of people that are so happy about this podcast? So many, people that are kind of stuck in the old generation. Why do you think this is so resonating with them?
I imagine, and some of this comes up for me too, is that it's like I can touch it, I can touch it inside of myself, is again that confirmation. For me, it's actually fear, but I think for some people, it's like this confirmation that change is always bad. We're leaning into secular ideas. We're leaning into worldly ideas, which I find so interesting because, so a few things I want to think about is that, first of all, like when the Rebbe, like in the beginning of the Rebbe's Nesias, he said, like, we're in this new country, a democracy. The Rebbe spoke about what a democracy is. And the Rebbe said, in this country, we make statements, or we have proclamations, or I don't, I'm not like a Bucky here, but there's something, you can Google it on Chabad.org. Like, so the Rebbe like leaned into like, this is how this country works, and we'll take upon ourselves some of the things of this country. The Rebbe used like cable television to get out the word. The Rebbe allowed videos and photographers in. So some of these all to me sound like, okay, so there are things we can change, we can move forward in time. And the interesting thing is that time is gonna move. Like Hashem makes time move, whether we like it or not. So we are either going to be held back, like not move forward with time. And then there's like a certain stuckness to that, right? Like if everything is moving along, we're aging, times are changing, there's technology, and we're very resistant to that. There's a positive and a negative. There's the negative is like there's a stuckness to that. And whenever you feel stuck, you don't feel alive, you don't feel vitality inside of you, you don't feel growth. And I think That is the case with a lot of the people. If you'll notice, the people who get like very, very activated when they hear about therapy or trauma, there's like a cynicism and a negativity. Like, to me, that's like a constriction. Like, it's a real sign of like stuckness. It's not curious and it's not vibrant and it's not happy. And then the positive thing about, being weary of change is that our communities, we live in this world, times change, but because we have like such strong values, we don't change as quickly as the rest of the world. So what really struck me is that she said in that podcast is she said that the children that were raising children in the 90s, and that would be me,
Right.
they all decided that they went to therapy and they were not going to raise their kids the way their parents raised them. So this didn't happen for our community until 20 years later, like if even.
So you're saying the from community has this difference between what she's talking about in the secular world, that we have a 20-year gap, you're saying?
Yeah, we have time on our hands. And with time, we're talking about time here, right? But meaning we didn't, I don't think our communities as a whole, you weren't hearing this kind of conversation about therapy and trauma and self-work in the secular, so to speak, sense, which to me it's not secular, but you didn't hear this language in our communities until in the last decade. So all of the like fear mongering that she's doing about what happened to our children and what's happening, like we have not been cooking in this for as long as the rest of the world
Right.
because it takes us time. We don't move ahead as quickly because we hold very strong to our values and we're almost like forced to move ahead. And then we move ahead, which is probably, it has, like I said, it's both, it's Hoshikaka practice, it's part of our. It's part of the reality. It is what it is. So I guess what I'm saying is like, we find ourselves here. It is what it is. We don't move back in time. We're not moving back into the shtetl. If Hashem wanted us to live in the shtetl, he would have put us back in the shtetl. I think some people try to create a shtetl, and the Rebbe didn't give that kind of messaging to us. The Rebbe told us to go out in the world, to be part of the world. And we hold our values very strong, and we hold, but I think you can kind of mirror this. And I think she got it wrong with what understanding what intentional or compassionate or empathetic, whatever the parenting, gentle parenting she called it. It's to me, it is strong boundaries with empathy. So maybe our generation grew up with a lot of strong boundaries, but it was scary. I think for Jewish parents, we have so much chesed in us, so it's hard for us to know how to even give boundaries. So when we give boundaries, it's so complicated. So we just give the boundary. And now if we have a little bit of openness and ease in the boundary, we also have room in our heads to think about, you know what? I can give this boundary with compassion. And it's that simple and that complicated. It is.
It's very hopeful. It's what you're saying is that not necessarily agreeing with certain parts, but saying we have this option, we have the opportunity to be able to take what we can from what she's saying and learn from it, meaning don't go overboard, learn how to give boundaries with empathy, learn how to do this with compassion. Let's not over pathologize our children. And it's not too late for us. It's really like we can take that message, apply it where we need to. And at the same time, realize that we can kind of fix what our older generation didn't get right with regard to setting boundaries, which was hard for our parents, and they did it harshly. We can do it with empathy.
Yeah, I don't even maybe 10 years ago, but like the age I am today, like I don't even think it matters who did what right. Everybody, we've talked about this, Razel. Everybody did the best they could. Everybody
Knowledge they have,
worked
yeah.
with the knowledge. It's something very interesting to me right now as we're talking. It's Tanis Esther. It's almost Purim, and I heard something so beautiful about Purim that Purim is all about leaning into not knowing. Right. So the whole notion that anybody knows, only Hashem knows, Purim is like this energy of frivolity, of lightness, and it's the ad delayada. And ironically, the more you ad delayada, the more you're missing the point. So Purim is about being light, being okay with not knowing, being okay with the unknown. And I think if we all like take a chillax, take a, and again, like ironically, you've got to be very in touch with yourself. You have to be very regulated in order to relax. How do we gain regulation? Well, we gain regulation by understanding our inner world. We understand who we are as a person, our bodies, how they connect to our brains. We get out of our brains, we get into our bodies. So all of that might sound like new jargon to people, but back to Purim for a second, is that it's this energy of like not being so uptight and caught up and thinking we have the right answers or they didn't have the right answers. None of that's the point. Like, we're living today, we have to live with what is. These are the children who are handed to us. This is the challenge that was handed to us. Social media, the openness of the world. The Rebbe sent us out on Shluchas, so we're like doubly exposed to the world. And we have to deal with what is in front of us. Like, what is the best way for me to manage my children today? If there's a fear of being progressive in any way or evolved or learning new things, then I just don't buy it. I don't buy that we're not allowed to take part in the good parts of the world. Like, this is being handed to us. So yes, we get to discern, we get to pick, we get to choose, but it's not like separated. You know, Haman's name is the name Mimuchan, preparedness. Now, Haman is that knowing, like, I've got this figured out. That is the energy of Amalek, is you know, you have this figured out. It's okay not to have it figured out. That's our work here in this world. Our work here in this world is trying to figure it out. So in the name of trying to figure it out, let's be honest about that and not be putting things out that say, I've got it right. You don't. Like,
Okay,
that's,
so
I think,
that
also kind of triggering. Like, you don't have it all right. You don't know all the answers
right.
because.
Let me pause you for a second because that brings up something for me that I want to ask. So you see that on both sides. You see that idea. I've seen people that claim to know everything about parenting and they have this figured out, or somebody who understands Hasidism and they have it all figured out. I'm saying, are you saying that this idea of saying I got this figured out is not okay? It's a malik. I mean, shouldn't we have an understanding and say this is figured out? We know this true. The Torah is true. Our values are true. We have that figured out, right?
Yes. But that's, you know, I read something from the Rebbe that the Rebbe, somebody was interviewing the Rebbe, asking the Rebbe questions about science and Torah. And the Rebbe said that if you look at how Torah has lasted, Yiddishkeit has lasted this long, you cannot say it was Eretz Yisrael because we haven't always had Eretz Yisrael. You can't say it was our language because we didn't always have our language. You can't say it was our culture. We didn't always have our culture. You can't say it was our clothing. You can't say all those things that, you know, they always told us this is what kept us. The Rebbe said it's not any of these things. It's our Torah and our mitzvahs. The way we get to our Torah and mitzvahs, the way we align ourselves, that is changing. The modalities that we learn, that is ever changing. These are just like dressings to how we're getting to our Torah and our mitzvahs. Because the bottom line is, we want children who are shomer Torah and mitzvahs, and we want healthy, regulated, emotionally resilient people. And we're saying today that maybe there is a something we can tap into. And you know, this is something I've been thinking about a lot. A lot of the people, or maybe I don't even want to say a lot, one or two or five, who are really like very much pushing against this whole notion of, I don't know, getting to know yourself or self-regulation or therapy or to me, the whole thing of gentle parenting is about self-regulation. So to me, it's like it goes like tongue and groove with Tanya.
Yeah.
Is a lot of, consider this, okay? This is just a thought I'm having. The people who are in their 50s, 60s today, or 70s, How old were they when the Rebbes talked? When they were sitting in front of the Rebbe, they were in their 20s, their teens, their 20s, their 30s. Have they considered that the way they heard things then, maybe they can hear it differently as adults? In the Gemara, it says it takes up to 40 years to understand what your teacher taught you. So could it be that the people who sat in front of the Rebbe have a certain narrative and it keeps replaying? They keep just replaying that narrative in their head to how they heard it at that age, at that time, with their mental and emotional capacity.
Right.
And perhaps going back to the Sichas of the Rebbe today with a fresh mind, like somehow clearing your whole mind, doing the work it takes to say, I am going to come back to these Sichas of the Rebbe and hear them in a new way, in a new world. What would that look like? I think that's what people like Rabbi Yossi Jacobson are doing. You know, our sister-in-law, Nachama Shusterman, she's teaching these sichas from Nun Aleph, Nun Beis. Like, she wasn't alive then, or she was alive, but she didn't learn from the Rebbe then. She was
right.
a child, but she's coming with new eyes and learning it. And I think that's so fascinating to me, is that it's the same Rebbe, it's the same words, it's the same Torah, but we are hearing it with new ears.
We're also hearing with our own experience, lived lives. So that does just like, you know, you learn the chitas and you each year you learn something new that you didn't hear about last year. Like the Torah is being read continuously, and yet there's new things that come up because the depth is endless. That's how the Torah is. And there's a lot of truth to that. I want to go back to what you were saying before about, I know that you know a lot about conscious discipline and, which is very in line with gentle parenting, whatever term you want to use for it. But you mentioned this idea about how we can set boundaries with compassion. Like instead of, you talked about this with me, that instead of having a dirty yes, I'd rather have a clean no. And I want to talk about that a little bit. And if you could tell us also, like, what does it actually look like to show up with boundary, to set a boundary with compassion? Because I think that's hard for us to envision, and I think it would be helpful to us to understand that.
Yeah. So my grandson was at my house the other day, and he did something, you know, that I could just feel. You know, he did something that all kids do. I don't know. He grabbed a toy from his sibling or whatever, made the other child cry, and I could feel rising up in me the other child, I need to hug him, and that child needs to be admonished. And it, like, I could feel that anger rising up in me. Like, I was in, you know, I've done enough work to be like in tune. I understand what's going on in my body. I'm not just like reactive, and not all the time. Like, it was a moment. It's not my own child, it's my grandchild. I have a certain amount of distance. I'm giving all, you know, credit to where it's due to my circumstance. And so my daughter, who I think practices this kind of parenting like in such a beautiful way, she took the child who needed hugs, she gave him hugs, and I'm left with the kid who had hurt. And I was like, and when I was raising my kids, that kid needed to be admonished. That kid needed to be punished. That kid needed to like get my scorn or disdain for their behavior. But
because otherwise, how would they know that they
exactly didn't like, how would they know, as opposed to like understanding like that child has shame. That child already is feeling so badly about what they did. They're already in their shame. And if I shame him some more, he's going to tell me I'm a stupid babe or all this, you know, Bobby, yeah. I'm actually like, they're going to tell me all the things that I know come after that.
Right.
And I just took that child who was the herder, who's left like feeling, I could tell, like a real toad. And I was like, you know, I just like continued with him, like, you know, oh, look at your brother. It looks like he's so sad. And then we like continued with the toys. And I like said, you know, it looks like we're going to eat dinner now. Let's clean up. And it was like so healing for me to be able to still love him and still mm-hmm. accept him for him and his humanity, that he hurt his sibling, because that's what kids do. But I could so feel where that like, nope, boundary, you know, you hurt your brother, it's not nice, say sorry, whatever that interaction was happened. But afterwards, he then didn't need to also be rejected. And I feel like we sometimes feel like we need to further reject the child because we're getting all that anger out of our body by seeing our other child hurt, or like looking into the future, catastrophizing, think, oh my goodness, my child's going to turn into a bully, or he's going to be mean. Oh my goodness, that's the worst thing in the world. So many conflicting emotions are coming up for us if we're not in control, that we leave these little children to feel so confused about what it is they just did, where their place is, how bad are they really? How bad was it what they did? But when you give it to them with love, they actually have the space to think about what they just did and feel bad about it. Because, you know, you mentioned conscious discipline. That's all about understanding how the brain works. How does the brain work when we feel anger, fear, shame? All of those uncomfortable feelings constrict our brain. They don't let us think about the things that actually connect us to our godly place, which is curiosity and empathy and connectivity. All of those things that are our better self are not accessed when we're in the fear brain. So if your child is afraid that you're going to yell at them, or God forbid, hit them, or do something that is really damaging to them, they can't access what you want them to access, that empathy and that love and that concern for their sibling.
Yes. And in addition, I think that what happens is, instead of feeling the shame and feeling bad about what they did, or let's say, I don't want them feeling shame, but let's say really reflecting on, oh, I shouldn't have done that, it becomes about you being the bad person. Now they have somebody else to hate on, and somebody else to be upset with.
Exactly. And then they spend so much time being angry at you, they can never go to the place of really reflecting.
Right.
Razel,
this is the most powerful part of all this, is because it gives them the excuse to not have to look at myself. I can be busy hating on you.
Exactly. Exactly. It's like a cycle of aggression.
Right. So let's talk about this a little bit, just for a few minutes. Can you give me an example of a clean yes, a clean no versus a dirty yes, or like with regard to any example you can with parenting?
Okay. So there was an article on COL about, let's go back to primitive parenting, which was, you know, all the comments are there for anyone to read. But one of the things in that article was, you know, today children are told not to jump on the couch because it's unsafe. God forbid, do you tell them don't jump on the couch because you're going to break it. Now, I don't agree that that's how parents are parenting. I think the difference today is that, let's say me, when I was raising my kids, I would have said to my kids, you know, in my 20s, early 30s, I would have said to my kids, stop jumping on the couch, you know, you're going to break it, get off the couch, and shikama vek, send them away, right? Maybe as I got a little older, I read a little more, I understood a little more about the brain, I would have said, come, let's play on the floor, right? If you don't say don't stop, all kids hear when you say don't jump on the couch is, oh, jump on the couch. They don't hear the negative. They just hear the positive and they continue jumping. So today, I think maybe the example is like an intentional parent is going to say, you will break the couch. It's not safe to jump on the couch. It might break. You might get hurt. And then they will take the child by the hand, or lift them by the waist, or take them kicking and screaming and say, come, it looks like you really need to jump. We are going to go outside on the trampoline and jump. So it's the knowledge that my kid has a need right now. It's not just, it's unsafe, you're going to break it. That's my biggest, like, okay, forget even the unsafe. You're going to break it. That's my biggest concern, that you're going to break the couch. You know what the message the kid gets? Is you care about the couch more than me. Because the kid knows intuitively that they have a need right now. My need is to run my motor really high. I am feeling like I need to jump, move, and have fun. And I hope no one is going to deny that kids have that feeling and need inside of them. So they have a very high motor running. They need to jump around. So a gentle parent, an intuitive parent, a conscious discipline parent is going to say, wait a minute, I'm not just getting my kid off the couch. What did I accomplish here? I accomplished having a whole couch. My couch is so important. No, my child is important. And my child has a need right now. So I'm going to get off my tushy, because I'm not just going to shik them avec. I'm not just going to send them out of the room or get them off the couch. I didn't accomplish what needs to happen here. I'm going to take my child and find something that fulfills that need inside of my child. Like they say, there's no bad children. It's good children having a hard time.
Right.
So
Well, then,
when
but then you're going to have naysayers, will tell you, well, why do we need to teach them that they're so important, that their needs are so important? Why is this an important thing to teach people? Like, no, you have a need, great, but there are other people here who have also have a need. Why is their need so important? Just teaches them that they're the most important thing. Like, they all that matters is their needs. What about your
well, I
mother's
mean,
needs or your siblings' needs or the teacher's needs?
and you know, sometimes you're not going to be able to take that kid and bring them to the trampoline because they might be jumping on the couch while you are in the middle of cooking for Pesach. You know,
Right.
right? It's true. So, but that's like we're not. It's not going to be perfect. Like we're not going to always be able to accomplish this. But shifting our understanding of it, shifting our just our intention behind it. And even saying to the child, like, here's a firm, you know, you may not jump on the couch, you're gonna break it, or it's not safe. Mommy's not gonna let you. You can either get off the couch now, or I'm gonna remove you from the couch. You remove the child from the couch. But you know what? You also look them in the eye and say, I can see you really wanna do something that's fun and jumpy. And I'm cleaning the chicken right now. I can't help you, but let's jump together. Me and you are going to jump in the kitchen. Let's see how many times we can jump in the kitchen. And each time I jump, I'm going to chop another leaf of lettuce. You know what? Do you want to help me chop lettuce? Let's see if your hands can jump. I can think of a thousand playful ways to get into it with my child that tells them that I care about them, that their needs are important. To somebody who says to me, like, why should your child like feel like they're the center of the world? I don't know. I'd probably say back to them, because that's the message Hashem gives me, is that, you know, we have two pockets, Bishvili Nivra Olam, you know, the world was created for me and I'm here to serve my creator. I don't know. There's like two
Yeah.
pockets. Like we can hold two truths. Like my child is the center of the universe, but my child's also not going to control my household.
Right. And so I think that's such an important point to remember. So basically, what we're really saying here, Dina, is that it really begins with us. Because if we can come to a place of regulation, and it's not like I'm going to a place of fear around this child, and I'm not going to a place of like what's going to be future casting and pre-suffering and grieving about what's going to be, rather be in the moment and say, what's coming up for me? What's happening with me here? I'm feeling disrespected. I'm feeling like out of control. What kind of mother are you that you have children that do these kind of things? What have you done that your child talks this way to you? You go to all those places, that's where all of this goes south. So
Right.
it begins
Or
with us.
it begins with us 100%. I saw this comment and I thought it's just too delicious not to repeat, is that somebody wrote that, you know, you're exalting the old style parenting. So the kids who were raised with these parents and in these amazing old fashioned institutions are the ones who are remaking everything today. So what happened?
Yeah.
We're the ones who are looking for new answers, and we were raised in the golden ages of the 80s and 90s. Clearly, clearly, we want to progress, not be progressive, but we want to move forward in the world that Hashem gave us, which is constantly moving forward. Yes, so like that.
One of the lines that was quoted in that article was, flowers don't bloom in powdered sugar. Flowers bloom in dirt. And I found that to be like, it wasn't explained, but I was like, yeah, you can kill a flower if you give them sugar. And also children, if you give them powdered sugar all day, they'll also won't bloom. But like, that didn't resonate with me even a little bit.
No, but I think his point was that if we're too kind to our
Yeah,
kids,
we're going to ruin our children.
we're going to ruin our children, right? But you know, life, this is, you know, the first time I heard this, it really resonated with me. Like life is going to give our children
Challenges.
challenges. And you know what? You know what this is? Just taking your kid off the couch, that is so much dirt. Taking your kid off that couch and telling your kid, no, you can't jump on the couch. That's dirt for the kid. Like, that's hard.
Yeah.
And we've got to get comfortable with our ch this is the other thing I think people don't sometimes don't understand, is that even when we're going to be doing all the gentle parenting or the intuitive parenting or the conscious discipline, our kids are still not going to show, our still kids are not suddenly turning into these compliant little, oh, thank you, mommy, for taking me off the couch. Oh, thank you for allowing me to jump on the trampoline instead. No, they're still going to fetch. They're still going to complain. Our teenagers are still going to be teenagers. They're still going to resent us and they're still going to sting. You know, we're still going to feel stung by their words, but we've got to, if we're comfortable in our own skin, if we learn to do the work of being embodied and being able to feel how we feel, and instead of reacting, we take that pause and that breath. How do we learn how to take that pause and that breath? We got to get into our bodies. We got to feel. I experienced something so beautiful the other day, is that, you know, when you're in your fear brain, okay, let's say I'm feeling very resentful about something. And, you know, somebody, I saw something online and it looks like this person's life is so much easier than mine, right? They had an easy shidduch or something happened, right? And I'm suddenly like, why can't that happen for me? And da da da. And I can go, I could start swirling. I'm in my brain, right? All the stories I'm telling myself, all the resentments. If I can pause and I can say, Dina, where do you feel this right now? I feel tightness in my chest. I feel heaviness in my legs. I feel ache in my back. Do you know what I'm doing? I'm letting the valve out. Instead of intellectualizing it, I let the valve out from inside. All that pressure goes,
right?
It disappears because you can't be in both places at the same time. Meditation, hisbeinonos, whatever you want to call it, it's clearing your thoughts away and consistently focusing on the body and the breath. All of the negativity, like you can, if I sit and cogitate in my negative emotions, I will sit, I will, there will never be enough reasons or answers. But when I move myself down into my body, I let the valve out.
Release the pressure. Yeah.
So like, and then something new comes up for me and those thoughts are gone. Those thoughts are
but
gone.
You can move forward. Yeah. It's forward moving. So what you're saying is a very important point. Like, people have this idea that gentle parenting or conscious discipline or any of these ideas should look pretty and not messy. And that is not true.
No.
Parenting, whatever way you choose, is still going to be messy. I think that's such an important point to keep in mind, that this is not supposed to be, any parenting style that you're going to choose is going to be messy and it's going to be complicated and it's not going to be quiet.
No.
And it's not supposed to be. That's where the expectation is, a wrong expectation around all of this.
Also, by the way, like the biggest point here that we're missing is that your children were given to you as a gift to take care of. The second thing your children were given to you as is a mirror.
Oh, yes.
Work. So if you are find yourself, this is a test, okay? For all the people out there, if you find yourself confused, frustrated, lonely, and like with a big fat question mark on your forehead all day when you interact with the next generation, take a good look. Take a good look at why. You can either crawl into your corner and say, I'm right, and I've been doing, and this is, there's something wrong with this generation. And you can pat yourself on the back and you can say, Shkayach, you're right, they're wrong. Or you can take a moment to pause and you can say, what can I learn from these kids? What am I missing? Help me understand what I'm missing. Because where I come from, we did things like this. And it seems like you're coming from a different perspective. Help me understand your perspective. When the youth of the 60s were acting like crazy cakes, the Rebbe said, we have something to learn from them. Like their enthusiasm, their desire for change. It's impressive. So like, I it's such a good test of, I do this for myself all the time. When I am feeling like alone in my environment, because everybody around me has a different perspective, then
I need to look in the mirror and see.
Probably need to look in the mirror. So if your children, if the people around you, the people you birthed are have a different perspective, and this is for all the middle aged 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s people, like, you know, then, like, you know, we all have to have a little humility and think, and not think just because, you know, again, the energy of Purim is like the being okay with the not knowing.
Yeah. And understand that we don't have this all figured out. We have to keep on growing with our children. That's what they're supposed to be there, right? Sar Gidl Bunim. They are helping us grow. We are growing through our children.
I want to say to the smug, like, letter writers of, like, this is the way it's done. Like, where's your mud? Where's your dirt?
Is it perfect? Well, is it
you,
all perfect?
You figured it out. So where's, so you're in powdered sugar now?
Right. Yeah, I know. And then I have to ask myself, well, where's that coming from? Razel, just take a chill. Like, that's not the point here. Right. But it's definitely an important piece of all of this. Okay. So basically what we've really summarized here and figured out is that we need to look in the mirror at ourselves and keep growing in ourselves, breathing, pausing, reflecting, and moving forward. Okay.
Can I just say one more thing?
Absolutely.
Okay. So this is like a theory I have, and, you know, for all the people who are looking at this generation and saying, like, where did these kids come from? I wasn't so sensitive. This was okay for me. Why is it so hard for them? Just something like very practical. Okay. The people who survived, the people who raised us, were the survivors. Okay. That means they were the strongest, toughest, baddest people of their generation. Okay. They were the survivors. Who's coming? Who is born next? We suddenly, the whole new generation was born and all types were born. And Baruch Hashem, they're all alive today. So you imagine that every single person who had all the parents, the people in there older than me love to say, sensory, what's the sensory thing? No one I knew had sensory. Really? If you had sensory issues.
You didn't make it through. You didn't survive.
Great. So the reason we have sensory people is because they came back. They're back. Hello. Like, the whole gamut of people came back. It was one type of person that raised us. And yes, those were the resilient, strong, calloused fingered women and men. But Hashem gave us this new generation, and it's not made up. You know, it's just, you can't say it's made up.
Yeah. Well, maybe if, you know, we didn't have the challenges of that generation, meaning the Holocaust or the starvation in Russia or the persecution, we might have had different parenting style, because we would have had different kind of people raising different children. But all we had really was this generation of strong survivors, which is a really good point. I never thought of that.
Yeah. So really, and that's what was, and they dealt with what is, and they did their beautiful work of raising a next generation. And now we have to deal with what is, and we got to look forward and take with us our Torah and our mitzvahs, and all the ways we accomplish that is we looking forward and you know, taking the good and you know, leaving behind in the shtetl, what's left behind in the shtetl.
Yeah. Wow, this was good.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being willing to have this conversation out loud in public.
Absolutely.
I'm going to wish you a Freilich and Purim.
You too.
Thank you, Tina.
Adela yada.
Okay, thank you to my sister-in-law, Dina. We are going to now move on to our next part of today's episode with renowned educator, Dina Gorkin, who is going to share her thoughts on this episode. I think you're going to find it interesting and informative. So sit back, relax, and be ready to grow. So welcome, Dina, to A Positive Podcast. I really appreciate having you here today. Reached out to you because I wanted to get your feedback and your thoughts on a popular podcast by Barry Weiss, which is really causing a firestorm of conversation for parents right now. The podcast title is Are the Kids All Right?, where she has Abigail Schreier on talking about her new book, which I haven't read yet. I did order it, but I didn't read it yet. But I listened to the podcast, I think, twice. And obviously, I think that it's important to mention that I was glad to listen to something different because I think it's important not to be an echo chamber of the same information that you have over and over again. Although every time I listen to a podcast by, let's say, Rabbi Jacobson or something that Shimon Russell or any of this idea of loving our children and connecting, and it's all about connection, even though it's the same ideas over and over again, I get so much from it each time. So I think it's important to keep listening to the material to help strengthen my my ideas and how to execute them properly. But what came up for me in this podcast was, besides the fact that she lumped a lot of ideas into one podcast, and there was a few ideas that I thought I agreed with, but overall I had many questions. And for starters, if you can start off by sharing with us your understanding of what gentle parenting is, because I felt that she took gentle parenting and she made it sound like it's permissive parenting. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this and on the podcast as well. I know I just went generally speaking, but if you could share your thoughts on that initial question.
Okay, so gentle parenting is it's very, very popular now. And I think I am not an expert on gentle parenting as a philosophy. But I think there are a lot of misconceptions about what gentle parenting is meant to be. And I think those conceptions are similar to the conceptions of the concept of time out and many other popular child rearing and child disciplinary measures that have come up over the years. Gentle parenting, from what I understand, is parenting children in an age appropriate way so that you're not expectations of a 10-year-old that you would have of a 15-year-old, and you don't have expectations of a 2-year-old that you should have of a 5-year-old. And whereas a lot of the old style parenting is reward and punishment based, you do this, I give you that, you don't do this, I take away that, or I give you something you don't want. Gentle parenting is more about trying to understand and be empathic and respectful of the needs of a child. So it's less authoritarian. It's more about recognizing where a child needs to be at a certain developmental stage, and then working with that. With that said, I think that there are people that take gentle parenting to the extreme and believe that they can never discipline children. That, if you raise your voice to a child, you're a monster of a mother. And that you have to give children choices about absolutely everything. And that's where I think, some people are really making a mistake in understanding what gentle parenting should be, which is, it's not just permissive and allow you just allow every single thing your child wants and give choices about everything. And I think a lot of people misunderstand that or misconstrue that. So.
Yeah. I think also that gentle parenting is a wonderful way of parenting. Like, it really resonates with me, but I think it's really challenging to execute properly. Meaning, parents love the idea, but they struggle with the concept of actually following through and actually setting up boundaries and putting them into place and holding that boundary and when they need to. And I think that that's the real what she's really saying, and she should have really dug into more, was that they start off trying to do gentle parenting and it turns into permissive parenting. And that's a challenge for a lot of parents. And I would have thought that she should have focused a little bit more on this idea that what's really not okay with our children is helicopter parenting, trying to overschedule our children, giving our children so many great things in their life that they're not even able to experience disappointment of any, like making sure that our children do not have pain and they're happy and they have everything they need so that they are just going to do wonderful. And what we're learning is actually children need struggle to be able to learn to build resilience and learn how to handle life and to handle challenges. And if we keep on cushioning every experience for our children, we're actually hurting our children.
Right. It's like, you know, you have a baby who needs to learn to crawl, right? So if every time the baby fetches a little bit, you put the baby on its stomach and it doesn't like tummy time. It doesn't like being on its stomach. So every time it cries, you just turn the baby back over. So she's happy. How does the baby learn to crawl? She needs that adversity. She needs that struggle so that she learns to build her arm strength so that she can lift herself up. And then she needs more struggle so that when things are out of her reach, she learns to reach. She learns to move her lower body in coordination with her upper body and be able to get to the object that she wants. And so every step of the way, you can thwart growth and development by giving into the child's resistance and struggle, or you can encourage development by being there next to the child and nodding and encouraging and touching and just doing whatever you can to support the struggle. Because if you take away the opportunity for the child to struggle, then you are, in fact, taking away growth and development.
That is a very good point. There is for sure there's something between these two ways of thinking, meaning between, let's say, getting on the floor and asking your child, why did you break the window? Or why did you rip the project? You must have been having huge feelings. You didn't know what to do with them. Or where the other generation where we yelled and hit, which many of us grew up with, and yet we turned out okay, which I hear a lot from a lot of people, which they all will say, well, we all turned out okay, which I beg to differ. I don't think so many of us turned out okay. But so in your opinion, where do you think we've gone too far? And what has fundamentally changed from the way our parents' generation raised us?
There is a famous joke that is told about social workers, but I just think it applies to lots and lots of parents today. This is a joke I probably heard 30 years ago about social workers, that the social worker is in the park with her child. Her child goes over to another child and for no reason at all, just smacks the child across the face and knocks him down. And the social worker runs over to her child and says, "Oh, sweetie, you must be having such a hard day to do something like that." And, you know, I think that's kind of where we've landed, which is not a good place for us as parents. It's not a good place for our kids. It's not a good place for the parent-child relationship, and it's not a good place for society. Because what we're teaching is lack of accountability. What we're teaching is that everything I do can be explained away by a feeling, and then you end up with these children growing up into adulthood being entitled, being unaccountable, and being mindless of other people's feelings and needs. So the balance is that when a child is doing something they shouldn't do, is defying a rule, or is hurting another child, yes, you do want to isolate them or you want to have a conversation with them. But the conversation has to focus both on what the child did and what the child was feeling that caused them to do that. So if you have two kids who are fighting and one takes the other's head and bashes it on the floor, it's not the right time to talk about their feelings. That's the time to say that was unacceptable. And there's some sort of consequence. Now, you don't have to be angry when you do it, and you don't have to be mean about the consequences, and you don't have to be out of control. And that's where I think we make a big mistake, that we think that all discipline is about being angry, mean, and out of control. Good discipline comes from a place of inner calm and peace, and a place of It comes from the mind, not the heart. It comes from our thinking, not our emotion. And, you know, we know this from Torah. We know this from all the Chachamim. We know that we are not allowed to discipline out of anger. So discipline has to come from a cognitive place, a very intellectual place, about analyzing what was done and then having a having a follow-up or consequence that is appropriate to the age level and understanding of the child. And then later you can talk about feelings. You can talk about, so when you did that, well, you know, you must have been feeling something really powerful. Can we talk about what that was? It's great. It's great for kids to be in touch with their emotions. You know, we don't want to go back to a time where everybody just bottled everything up and nobody was self-aware, and it affected us in very negative ways. It affected marriages, it affected parenting, it affected parent, you know, adult parent-child relationships. We don't want to go back to that. So we do want to talk about emotions, but we don't want to talk about emotions to override everything else.
Well, talking about emotions is okay, but the question is when we're talking about it, and it is followed by the right time. Just like when, you know, when your child's in the heat of the moment, you're not going to try to calm them down. You wait, you know, you wait until they're in a more, you know, rational mind space that you could actually rationalize with them. So the same way, at that moment, it's not the time to talk about feelings. You're saying there's a time and place for that.
Right. And not only that, you know, talking about emotions should be something that we do with our kids in arbitrary moments, not only when they do something that has them acting out, but we should talk about emotions like as a regular, normal, everyday thing, because emotions are a regular, normal, everyday thing. And we can talk about all types of emotions, not just anger and frustration that cause kids to act out, but let's talk about feelings of disappointment or boredom or excitement, anticipation. There's so many emotions that we can address and talk about in calm times, rather than trying to always address emotions when the emotions are at their height.
Okay, so then this brings me to another question that I have. On her podcast, Abigail Schreier talks about this idea, and she said the number one cause of depression is rumination or dwelling on past pains and rehearsing your past pains over and over again. And we have more rumination and more discussions about our feelings than ever before. Asking your child how you're feeling or how that brought, what that brought up for them, actually makes a person less happy. This is what she says. Mm-hmm. So she's saying that leaning into these feelings is leading to more anxiety and depression. And that's why we're seeing such higher numbers. Yet therapists talking about our feelings and our emotions all the time. We discuss this, and parenting coaches and parenting therapists are telling parents that they should be talking about their child's feeling at the right time. And then in addition, I want to talk about this for a second. Yesterday's Hayim Yaim talked about this idea that one action is worth more than 1,000 sighs, right? So yes, obviously an action isn't the same as a feeling, but the message really is saying that the same concept is, don't focus on how much you're feeling, get up and do what you have to do. Like, take that and go do what you have to do, you know, do the right thing. And then I know from Chassidus, another Hayim Yaim, the Rebbe Rashab talks about this idea of, right? That you should talk out your feelings, that helps us. So we have so many, I mean, not conflicting, because it's somewhat sounds conflicting. And then, I mean, obviously people need to think for themselves, which I think is an important thing. We kind of have forgotten how to think for ourselves, and we're so busy trying to get every expert to tell us. But when you have all these different information, like this overload information, it's hard to figure out which is my true voice that I need to be listening to. So what are your thoughts on this?
So I have a few different thoughts on it. Number one, that if you want to go back to Tanya, the Alter Rebbe tells us that we are capable of holding different emotions at the same time, right? We're always feeling, and we're always thinking and ruminating. That's the human condition. However, it's in the recent Tanya, and in many prakim of Tanya, the Alter Rebbe says, mitzvahs, maisiyas are the most important. It was just the other day, the most important thing we can do are the practical mitzvahs. And yes, learning mitzvahs of thought and speech are important, but lemaisa, mitzvahs, maisiyas are the most important. So thought and speech are important. How can you be a centered and successful human being if you negate one side of yourself. That means you have feelings, but you don't ever allow expression of those feelings in an authentic way, or you squash those feelings because I don't want to ruminate on them. And then again, back to Tanya, the Alter Rebbe talks about in the late 20s of Prakim, set aside time to think about the things that you're sad about, the things that you're struggling with. Set aside time. It should not overtake your day. It should not be the thing that you are spending, you know, 80% of your time on. Your actions are the things you should be spending 80% of your time on. And you should have set times to think about and talk about what you're feeling. So if we take our roadmap of how to raise our children from the Rebbeim and from Chassidus and from Torah, then we know that it is important to think about your feelings and to work out your feelings, but it's a part of you. It's not all of you. And I think perhaps what she's alluding to or directly stating is that we've made our emotions the primary thing in our lives. We've just allowed emotions and emotional health and well-being to overtake everything. And it has some pretty devastating results because kids can't compartmentalize anymore. Now everything is about their emotions. They're just bleeding emotions. And I had recently a conversation with a student where there has been some trauma identified in her past. And she was concerned about addressing the trauma because she's afraid that if she addresses it, then her life is just going to spiral downward. And we had a conversation about having a box in your head for the trauma and for your therapy sessions where you're treating the trauma, and recognizing that just because you had a trauma, and we're not talking about something devastating where literally takes over her life, but there was a trauma, just because you had a trauma doesn't mean that you're now excused for every single other thing in your life with your trauma as your excuse note. So just teaching our kids to compartmentalize your feelings. It's great, you know, wonderful. And we have those and we can talk about feelings. And it's important to talk about feelings because they are part of us, but it doesn't become the overarching theme of everything that we think and do.
We have to learn how to compartmentalize and be able to separate. And it's not about avoidance, which I think in past generations, we were like, just push it aside. Don't think about it. But that idea, there is a time and place for that approach as well. Because there's when you need to get up and do what you got to do, you actually need to push it away with both hands. Right?
Yes,
that's
exactly what I was thinking.
Right. You got to push it away. There are times for that. And then there are times to feel it. But you need to feel it to deal with it, to heal it. You need to.
Yes.
And that's something that I think we have a hard time with. But I think like what you're saying is a very good point. I know a coaching client of mine reached out and was asking me this question. She said, you know, I struggle with sadness, feeling sadness. And my therapist keeps telling me, you need to lean into your sadness. You need to allow yourself to feel it. And she's really struggling with that. She said, I don't think that's the Chassidus approach. Why should I lean into my sadness? Where would it say in Chassidus that I should lean into my sadness? Shouldn't I just push it away? And so for me, what comes up is, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that, is I feel like the reason why you're not dealing with it is because there's some thought in your mind that being sad is really, really not okay. It's not only not okay, it might be even bad. And there's like this like visceral like objection to it. And that your body, you don't want to go there at all. And you're so busy fighting it that I think you need to learn how to accept it and say, yes, I struggle with being sad. Now, that's not who I am. That doesn't mean I have to give into it. That means there are times where I need to lean into it. So what is that? So in your opinion, what do you think it means to lean into your sadness if you feel sadness? And what's an appropriate amount? Could you speak to that?
Yeah, sorry about that. I'm not sure what this therapist intended for her in terms of leaning into her sadness. So, you know, does she mean like really, really focus on it a lot outside of the therapy room? Or does she want her to do that specifically in the therapy room, which would be like Walter Rebbe's prescription, which is find set times to address your emotions. You know, if the therapist wants her to do this expansively, then I don't think that's productive.
I think it's more about, if you're feeling sad, lean into it.
Allow yourself to feel it.
Allow yourself to feel it. Allow yourself to wash over it, to not be so afraid of it, to look at it in the eye and say, what are you here to tell me? Because that's what emotions are their signals. They're trying to tell us something. And then after you've allowed yourself to feel it and it's uncomfortable and you don't like it, then you could move past it. It's not about living
right, there. So I think the therapist has to give her some tools for coming out of sadness when she leans into it, because the fear is, if I lean into it, I may never be able to stop. Hmm. And I had this with a student a number of years ago where she really went through something difficult and she was in therapy, but she would sit in therapy and not talk. And at one point I said to her, you know, what's going on? How's the therapy going? She said, well, you know, nothing's really happening. It's not a good therapist. I said, tell me about that. And she started telling me what's going on in therapy. And I said, is it not a good therapist, or are you just not doing therapy? Mm-hmm. And it turns out she wasn't doing it. She was just talking about random mundane things that were happening in her life or not talking at all. And we had a conversation about why she wasn't talking. And it finally came out that if she would talk about what happened to her, she would start to cry and she would never be able to stop. And that is a very big fear. If you're a person that's, you know, running a family and you're working and you have a shlichus and you have, you know, things going on in your life, maybe you're taking care of older parents, you have a lot going on, or you have a little going on, but you have to keep it together. How are you going to keep it together if you have no tools to pull yourself back together after leaning into sadness? And it feels too scary to let go if you won't be able to get control back. So I think what the therapist really could do for her is, in a session, help her to lean into that sadness and then give her the tools for being able to pack it up and put it back in that box and revisit it when it's appropriate. And it's not only appropriate in the classroom. Maybe there's something that happens in her life once in a while that makes her sad. But then when she's out of the therapy room, she can lean into the sadness and know how to put it back in the box.
So let's go back to the Abigail Schreier's whole podcast here. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on what she said with regard to over-pathologizing our children, over-medicating our children. I agree with the fact that many of the things that she said, but I just feel like everything, it's a cycle, and we, you know, the pendulum swings from side to side. I'm just curious, what were your thoughts overall? And if you could share a little bit more about that piece of it.
I definitely see a lot of over-medicating going on. And then on the other end of the spectrum, I see kids that would thrive if they had a little bit of chemical help and aren't getting it. So it can go either way. I think right now the pendulum is swinging more towards over-medicating kids. There's a really wonderful TED talk by Ken Robinson, where the talk is called "Do Schools Kill Creativity?" It's one of the early TED talks that I remember seeing. And there's one point in the talk where he describes a woman that he's interviewing, and she describes herself as a little girl not being able to sit still in school. And it was 1930s. And I love what he says over there. He says, ADHD hadn't been invented yet. People weren't aware they could have that condition. So the school wrote to her parents and told the parents that that she's a problem. So she took this little girl to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist spoke with her and then told her, you know, I've heard what you have to say, and now I'm going to go talk to your mom outside the room. And as he's walking out of the room, he turns on the radio and he leaves the room and he tells her mother, stand with me outside the room and watch your daughter. And within a few seconds, she was up on her feet dancing. And she was dancing around the room while the doctor was outside the room. And the doctor said, "Do you see your daughter? There's nothing wrong with her. She's a dancer. Take her to a dance school." And the mother took her to a dance school, and she eventually ended up in the, this was in England, in the Royal Ballet. She eventually became an award-winning choreographer for Broadway shows. She became a multimillionaire, highly successful. And what she said was that when I first went to the dance school, I saw a lot of people like myself, people who needed to think, to move in order to think. And there's so much individualizing going on for kids in school that it's surprising to me that we don't say more things like that. These are people who need to move to think. These are people who need to sing to think. These are people who are sad because they are being put in environments where they can't learn. These are children who are anxious because they are introverts being forced into an extrovert environment every day. So what we're doing is we've created this school system where supposedly we're individualizing, but we aren't really. We're really creating schools that have this, you know, almost assembly line approach. And it's sort of, you know, we're individualizing by saying, oh, this one needs special ed and this one needs medication and this one needs therapy. But what they really need is often being overlooked. And what they really need is often just a very different type of school environment. And then when you put kids who are real introverts into an extroverted environment all day, or kids who have some sensory issues into a noisy environment all day, kids who need to move but are being forced into a chair and feeling like failures all day, yes, you end up with a lot of anxiety, a lot of depression, and a lot of dysfunction. So I believe as an educator that it's the school systems that need to change, as well as the approach regarding therapy, as well as the, you know, parents being all freaked out that, you know, if something isn't perfect, my child needs to run to a therapist.
Right. And then you would say the parents might respond and say something to the effect of, well, my child feels like they are not doing well in school, but I can come home and I can make the home environment somewhere where they excel. I can take them for dance class after school. I can show them different ways of who they could be and who they are and how wonderful they are. And in that regard, you might say, well, this child's been in school day. They cannot do this homework. And that's where parents start to come in and say, well, my child can't do this, or they're trying to make excuses for their child. And that's where you have these mechanchim who say that parents are making it worse for their children because they're not on the school side. They're not seeing it the school's way. And I don't see it that way. I see it more of the effect that the parent sees this child for who they truly are and is trying to make, I want to say, accommodations. Yeah, that a child that sits in school from 8:30 in the morning till 6 p.m. or 5 p.m. for some of the boys, and then they come home, they need, at least my children, need to have outlets. They cannot be sitting again for another 25 minutes or even 20 minutes doing homework. It is not beneficial for the child. So a parent might come and make excuses. And this is where you have these articles by mechanchim who are saying the parents should be on the school side. What would you say to that?
Oh, that's a tough one, because I'm, you know, I've been a parent for many years, and I'm also the school. But I learned something from our family doctor many, many years ago, Dr. Plout, who's the greatest. And I learned from him that you have to listen to the parent. Now, are there parents that are going to drive the school administration crazy because they want something for their child that in the opinion of the educators working with the child, that child does not need or shouldn't have, or you know, that the parents are completely off base? Yes, you have those parents. There are parents who just don't know what their child needs and just want them to be happy, right? Like you discussed in the beginning, my child has to be happy. But I would say that the majority of parents are intuitive enough about their child's needs that schools need to listen to parents respectfully. School administrators, teachers, need to listen to parents not as the expert, I know what to do. Leave that at the door when you're having a conference with the parent. And just hear the parent as a parent. Rather than, you know, coming in as the expert and having your answers ready as to why you're not going to do what this parent wants. And I've learned so much from parents over the years. And even if I don't agree with what the parent wants for the child, I think it's important to sit and explain to the parent what you're seeing and where you think what they're suggesting might work and where it might not be advisable. Show willingness to try what the parents are asking if it's reasonable, and just have, you know, help the parents to feel like you're their ally. I think that the, you know, this parent versus school mentality is really ingrained in society in many ways, not just our society, but in society in general, parent versus school. And it's on the school to make the parents see that this is different, that now it's different. We're a team. We work together. Tell me what your child needs. And I'll sit and listen to a parent tell me about a child not feeling well. And we'll have a whole conversation about, well, have you tried, you know, this type of doctor? And have you tried changing the child's diet? And let's talk about what you've already done. And let's talk about what some other options are. And, you know, I had a parent a couple of years ago that the child had a similar situation, and this is what she did. And just brainstorm about the child rather than it being parent versus school. Parent knows what the child needs. School says it knows what the child needs, and now we butt heads. It doesn't benefit the child. And if we're all in it for our children, then we need to work together humbly to figure out what our children need. And it really starts with the school changing that culture of, you know, we're in the know, mm-hmm. and we'll tell you what we think should be done.
Right. So they say things cycle. And I know that we certainly overcorrected for parenting mistakes that our parents made. And I'm sure our children will overcorrect mistakes that we made. I hope by the time my children are raising children, screen time will be seen like cigarette smoking. Phones will be considered like as dangerous as a cigarette is and kind of forbidden. But what would you say we overcorrected and could dial back on now? And what do you think we changed and are getting just right?
That is a great question. I think we definitely overcorrected on the strictness, and we're going to, you know, like permissiveness or just unconditional love versus appropriately expressed love. And love for a child obviously should be unconditional. You know, we take our cue from the Abishter, who, no matter what crazy things we did as a nation, Abishter always forgives. So I think definitely we've overcorrected in that respect. You know, if you speak to a parent and the parent tells you a story that their child said or did something at school and the teacher said, how dare you? Who says how dare you today? Right? I grew up on a diet of how dare yous. And we just don't do that today. So we've gone in a good direction, but I think have overcompensated for those, you know, things where teachers shamed kids on a regular basis and, you know, just didn't see children as people and certainly didn't have the concept of respect for children. And when I say respect, I'm actually going to take a page out of Shea Taub's playbook. Someone who took his parenting course was telling me that he was talking about respect of children and explaining what it means. It doesn't mean bowing to your children's desires. It doesn't mean asking them for permission to do anything. What it means is that if you see your child sitting and playing peacefully and you want to give your child a hug, but your child is really just like really engaged in play, and you walk over to your child and you have him stop his play to give you a hug, perhaps that was not respectful because the child was doing something that was really important to him, and he was really engaged in it, but you needed a hug. So that's the idea of being respectful of children, respecting that when they're doing something, it's important to them. That even if they're two or three, especially as they get to be teenagers, realizing that, you know, a lot of times we'll yell to a child in another room, Yossi, please go and help Bubby and Daisy with their luggage. They're coming into the house. You wouldn't do that to an adult. You'd walk over to the adult and you would say, listen, you know, my parents are coming into the house and they need some help with their luggage. I'm sorry to interrupt what you're doing. Would you please go help them? And so there's that nuance of, like, you know, just being respectful of them because our children are tzelem elokim, because they are a gift from the Eidosher, just being respectful of their personhood, but not going to the extreme of, you know, oh, Yossi, Bubby and Davey are here. Do you want to help them with their suitcases? No. Right? So not overcompensating. And I think we do. I think we started overcompensating. I think we've gone way overboard with respect being misunderstood in terms of how we speak to our kids. But I think what we've gotten right is that it's gentler. It's a lot gentler now than it used to be. And you don't have the shame. I mean, I could tell you horror stories of some of my experience as a kid watching things that teachers did. And my MO in school was stay under the radar. That's how I got through school. Stay under the radar. Whatever you do, stay under the radar. And that's not how a child should feel in school. Child should feel safe in school. We didn't feel safe.
How can you learn otherwise if you're not in safety? Your brain is not even fully in its space for learning.
That's true. I mean, honestly, have to question how I learned in some of the classes that I was in because there was so much fear. You know, Yerushalayim is not about being too afraid to do anything. Yerushalayim is being aware that there is the Eidosher, being aware of the Eidosher's presence, but not being afraid. It's awe. It's not fear.
Right. So she mentions another line in the podcast where she says that parents don't realize that therapy comes with any risks at all.
Mm-hmm.
What are the risks that parents have to keep in mind when they're thinking about therapy, finding a therapist? What are the risks? Number one. And number two, can you help tell parents maybe some ideas of what they should keep in mind when looking for a good therapist? What do they should look out for? What they should avoid?
There are risks with any medical care, right? You want to know that the doctor you're going to has a good reputation, has a good track record with dealing with everyday, you know, illnesses and so forth. The same thing goes for a therapist. Before you submit your child to therapy, you want to make sure that the therapist has a good track record, that people recommend this therapist because A, he or she was kind, B, he or she was respectful both of the child and the parent, and C, that he or she had goals. Now, if the therapist is just not, you know, doesn't have such a great reputation, run the other way. If you hear good things about a therapist, interview the therapist before you send your child to therapy. Pay for a session where you speak to the therapist and you ask, what methodologies do you use? What are your goals? Where do you see this going? My child is really struggling socially, and, you know, no matter what we've tried, we've not been able to help her with her social skills. What would be your goals in therapy for my child? What's the time frame that you see this, you know, this happening in? Have you dealt with other children similar to her? And what was the progress you saw with those children? You want to ask key questions so that you feel confident that this is a person that is going to be kind, respectful, and have a path. Therapy should not be a financial black hole. Therapy is not meant, I mean, the types of therapies that we're sending our kids today are meant to help give our kids tools to help them feel safe in the therapy room and start to feel safer out of the therapy room as well, because they can trust themselves, because they are more resilient. So there have to be goals, and the child has to be getting tools in the therapy room. I think it's important to find a therapist that has a personality that clicks with your child. So if you've started therapy, you know, the first session should be you together with the child, also depending on the child's age. Like, I'm thinking of younger kids, but if it's a teen, the teen probably doesn't want you in the room. But listen to the child if she's telling you, I really don't like going for therapy. She's mean, or she's, you know, doesn't listen to me, or I don't feel like I'm progressing. And you have to really pay attention to those kinds of statements. Now, sometimes it's a reluctance on the child's part to really open up. And sometimes it's just not a shidduch. So having conversations about it can help you determine whether it's the child being resistant or whether it's not a shidduch. But those are things that one has to really, those are the things one has to pay attention to, I think, when sending a child to therapy.
Okay. So in this podcast, Abigail gives a full dismissal of this idea that the body keeps a score. She totally negates it. She says there's no proof for it. She says that there's no clear evidence. And I found that to be quite incredible of her to say, because I didn't hear so much data that backed her up. I'm curious, because I personally have experienced this truth in my own life and with people that I'm close with, and I've seen it. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this. And also in general, do you feel that the Tara agrees with this idea of the body holds trauma, and it's felt, and we could feel it within us? Are there any sources for this? What are your thoughts on this whole dismissal of her giving the body keeps a score? Like, she just completely debunks that.
I was quite surprised to hear that from somebody who sounds very intelligent and very well thought out and well researched. Because long before there was Bessel van der Kolk, there was Sarno.
Yes.
Thank you. Sarno is like the king of explaining physical pain that comes from stress. And they had studies, they have tons of data of scans of people who were not complaining of any pain at all, and people who were complaining of debilitating back pain. And they found that, I forgot the percentage, but in a huge percentage of people, there is disc degeneration. There are, there's subluxations and all kinds of abnormalities and maladies of the spine that people have throughout life. Yet the people who were suffering from pain, it was like almost 100% of them were going through major stresses in their lives that were being translated into physical pain. So you could have two people with the exact same condition, and one was walking around playing tennis and just going about their merry life, and the other one was bedridden from pain. And you know, Sarno really put two and two together and said, stress has an incredible effect on the body, and trauma is a stress. So you can't say that, you know, stress of dealing with a parent in the hospital, that's not really trauma, that's like normal life stuff, and that can cause back pain, but actual trauma, that can't cause back pain. You can't. It's all stress. So I actually was very surprised at her take on this, because there is scientific data to really back up that trauma has a physical effect on the body. I've done some trauma training. Can't say I've done a lot of trauma training, but I actually watched in the sessions that I took, The person who's the trainer, her name is Ricky Bernstein, and she's phenomenal. She lives in Israel, and she deals with like the most traumatized Chayalim. And so she did in these trainings, she would take volunteers from the participants, all of whom were therapists or, you know, people in mental health. And she would do a session in front of our eyes, a somatic session, where using somatic intervention, which connects mind and body, she would have the person speak about something that they went through. And we actually watched their body movements change. We watched people who seemed perfectly composed all of a sudden burst into tears for no apparent reason, because they had just held themselves in a hug, or they did something physical that released something emotional from a trauma that they experienced. So I have to humbly say that, you know, Amy Schreier is a lot more informed than I am and a lot more knowledgeable on all areas of mental health. But just from what I know, what I've researched, and what I have read and experienced, I know that the body holds trauma. I know I've had my own personal experiences.
Right. I do say, though, the difference between Sarno and Van der Kolk is that Sarno says you don't need to know your trauma. He talks about how, you know, you don't really need to know it. You just need it. Your brain has to accept the fact that that's what's going on. And once your brain accepts that information, the pain will subside and release the oxygen to those areas of your back. Because what his whole theory is that the brain is concerned that you can't handle what's really going on. So it wants to deflect you from those thoughts and instead sends you to think about your pain.
Right. As I tell people all the time, you know, sometimes you experience something and it's too much for your brain, and your brain says, "Hey, I can't do this, body take over." And that's when you get these kinds of chronic pains, chronic health conditions.
Yeah.
So
it's fascinating, because honestly, I found it to be really hard to believe that she was just throwing it all away. If she would have said something to the effect of, everyone is over traumatized, everyone is, we're telling people that they have a trauma. Like, for example, you know, I was listening to Buria Efun. She wrote something about the soldiers that saw things that were really terrible on October 7th, and they experienced really bad things. What they're doing with them is like a whole different trauma approach, where they're having them, I think I'm quoting her correctly, but something to the effect of, they give them a break for a little bit, but then they put them right back into it. Because the idea is to help them to understand that they can build resilience. You can go through hard things, but you can get back into it. When you tell soldiers or people that have gone through traumas that now you're broken, now you're ruined for life, this is it, you need to go and sit in a chair, that traumatizes them even more than the trauma that they went through, and gets them stuck in that in that space of, I cannot get over this. So if she would have said something,
I think she said that. I think she quoted that.
Okay.
She was talking about how in the Israeli army, it's the most resilient army.
Right.
And she actually quoted that.
She mentions this idea, but that's not what she's using as her, what she's saying about trauma. She's trying to say that trauma in general, your body doesn't keep any score. There's no such thing as body memory. No, it's not, just not true. Like, she just says it completely. And then even if she would say something to the effect of, we tell everyone that it's a trauma when these small things that are happening to them are parts of life. Pain is a part of life. Losing a grandparent is a part of life. Yes, it's true. We're over traumatizing people. We're telling them that we're over labeling, I should say. I would have understood that, but to take that kind of research and just to wipe it all off, it just seemed a little bit ridiculous to me. So just one more thing that I wanted to ask you. Do you know if the Torah agrees with this idea? Do you find any ideas of this in Chassidus, any sources for this? I mean, to me, the idea that the body is a vehicle for the neshama, I mean, that's a big part of it. But I'm just curious if you know anything more about Torah's view, Chassidic view of this idea that the body holds on to, the body keeps the score.
Well, if you look at Yom Kippur davening, right? And we say achet. What do we do when we say achet? Right? We do an action. Yes, we do an action, right? What is the purpose of that action?
I would imagine that the purpose is to like feel it, but like it's, and our heart. So it's like, I guess it's a combination. I never really thought about this. It's a really good point. I think it's something, it's not about hitting myself. I'm not hitting myself. I used to think right. that as a kid that I'm hitting myself. No, right. it's more, I guess it's more about feeling it in my heart. I don't know. What are your
yeah,
thoughts?
It's doing a physical action to remind us that there's a connection between what we thought and what we feel and what we do. Right. So it's making that total connection of, you know, I thought this thing, it wasn't a good thing. I felt something and then I did it. So now I'm doing this physical action to remind me. Action, feeling, and then has to go back to my thought. And we talk about this a lot in Chassidus, Machshava Dibur and Maisa, right? What's Maisa? Maisa is your body. This, again, circling back to the concept of what's the most important thing, physical mitzvahs here on this earth. Our body is the greatest expression of the Shechina. The greatest way that we can bring the Shechina down into earth is through the act of our body, right? So if Kedusha can come through our body, right? That's spiritual. Certainly emotional can come through our body. We're all connected. Like Chassidus is constantly reminding us how it's all connected and you cannot separate them out and say, this is who you are. You're only your body. You're only your neshama. You're only your intellect. It's all connected. To dissect it in such a way and say, well, trauma is only in the brain. Nothing is only in the brain. Hunger isn't only in the brain. And it's not only in the body. It's both. People who struggle with food addiction, they don't only get them to limit their food. They also have to get them to limit and change their thought process, the emotions that they have connected with food. I don't think it's ever correct to say that something is only in our brain, because that invalidates the idea that we are, you know, physical, cognitive, emotional, spiritual beings.
Yeah, it's a really good point to keep in mind. Okay, I just want to finish up with one final thing. What do you think is the most important thing that parents need to keep in mind when parenting a child? What is one of the most important things to keep in mind, to focus on, to remember, to be able to really step into being a parent, a good parent, a good enough parent, a parent the way we want to show up as parents?
Resilience and authenticity in the parent. Because when we model those things, our children absorb it. So if I am feeling anxious all the time, that is going to translate to my kids, even if I look like I have it all together. If I am inauthentic with my kids by having it all together all the time, even though I feel anxious, that actually makes my kids more anxious. My mother can't be real with me. She's always got to hide whatever it is that she's feeling. So if we work on our own resilience, and if we are feeling anxious, if we are feeling, and who as a parent isn't anxious, right? Every time our kids go someplace, we're not anxious. We hear terrible stories. And that's another thing, by the way, just put away the social media. Just put away the phones, get rid of your Instagram. You don't need to see who has the best and the greatest and the most expensive and the most successful anything. It's just not important to your life. You have these kids. You can turn out into the world amazing, incredible, productive, and slightly flawed people. Or you can turn out into the world a bunch of nervous, suppressed, angst-ridden, semi-dysfunctional adults. And that's a huge, huge order, right? It's a huge responsibility. But if you can put aside everything else, all the distractions, all the unimportant things like knowing what, you know, which, let's think of my own kids, which knit outfits are in style for your 18-month-old, and just dress them, right? Just be. and stop competing with the world. Just slow things down, go back to, and I'm not saying in every way, but just go back to 1960 in terms of the amount of information you take in. You'll be significantly less anxious yourself, significantly more resilient. And then if you're more resilient, you can be authentic with your kids. And when something comes up that does make you anxious, you can say, wow, this, I just noticed I'm feeling really anxious about this. I'm going to do something and say what the something, you know, I'm going to go take a break. I'm going to go, you know, read something so that I'll feel better. So then you're modeling authenticity. You're also modeling solutions, right? You're showing your kids, I don't have to stay stuck in my anxiety. I don't have to stay stuck in these feelings of, you know, lack of energy. There's something I can do about it. And if we're able to do that, I think we'll raise the generation that's ready for Mashiach.
Yes. So it begins with us. Yeah. Because in order to have a generation that's ready for Mashiach, we're the generation. The Rebbe told us that.
So we're raising them. That's my number one parenting tip, is work on yourself. Find, if you need to get outside help, get some outside help. If you need to speak to other parents who are not going to make you feel more pressured to do more things, but who are really going to support you, right? If you have a support system and ways of just taking some deep breaths. This is one thing I wish I would have known when my kids were little, and that is somatic exercises. Deep breathing. And my father, who was way ahead of his time, my father would be 100 today, was way ahead of his time. He had us doing deep breathing when we were kids.
Yeah.
But okay. I didn't follow it up. I didn't teach it to my kids, and I should have. And that's one thing that I really do regret, not teaching my kids how to relax, how to go inside. And just, you know, just go inside for a moment. Go, you know, monitor your body from head to toe, see where you're holding tension, let it go, and move on.
Don't get stuck in that.
Yeah, don't stay stuck.
Thank you so much. This was so helpful and so informative, and I just really enjoyed it. So thank you, Dina.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure for me.